Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. You have probably all noticed a new breed of very militant atheists who are selling their books, making the New York Times bestseller list routinely now. They're getting a lot of face time in the media. They're making quite an impact in our cultural conversation. One of those who has responded quite publicly to this new militant atheism is best-selling author Dinesh D'Souza. And he's going to be with us on the program in just a few moments for a live interview. We're going to have a great conversation. Dinesh D'Souza is well-known to many of you. He is a prominent author and media personality. He's a scholar right now at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. His new book is entitled, What's So Great About Christianity? And we'll be talking to Dinesh D'Souza in just a moment. First, a review of some issues in the news. The Boston Globe is out with a report from Charleston, West Virginia, suggesting that one sign of the times is that Marshall University has decided to allow students to take pagan holidays, just like other students would take Christmas or Thanksgiving or some other kind of holiday for one of the traditional faiths. This is indeed from the Associated Press, reported by the Boston Globe. It says when George Fain visits a grave to mark a pagan holiday, she won't have to worry about the work she's missing in her class at Marshall University. That's because her absence Thursday on the Samhain holiday, Samhain being a pagan holiday, has been approved by the Huntington School, which for the first time is recognizing pagan students' desire to be excused from class for religious holidays and festivals. The Associated Press reports that this university has an enrollment of 14,000. It may be the only school in the country to formally protect pagan students from being penalized from missing work that falls on religious holidays, although others have catch-all policies, they say, protect students of every religious faith. Now, later in the article, it says this. Jason Pitsey Waters, an authority on paganism, who edits the Wild Hunt website, a blog about pagan religion, politics, and culture, says that by specifically including pagans, Marshall University is taking an important step toward recognizing, quote, the validity of their beliefs. He went on and said, that's part of the struggle for modern pagans. Even though modern paganism has been in public since the 1950s, a lot of people still see it as rebellious teenage activity, not necessarily something you do as religious observance. Now, what makes this story all the more fascinating is that even after he says that, you have Marty Laubach, a sociology professor at Marshall. He's an advisor to a group of pagan students. He says and complains that flyers advertising pagan meetings have been ripped down by others. You'll recall that the man we just cited a moment ago, this is Jason Pitsey Waters. He said they're drawn together as a legitimate religious observance. But he also said what binds us together isn't our theology necessarily. What binds us together is a sense of communal practice and togetherness. Now, the reason why he has to say that what binds us, meaning the pagans on this campus, together isn't our theology necessarily is that many of them have no theology at all. And it's just an embrace of ancient mythological and pagan rituals. And I don't know what you're going to think about this in terms of a university giving the time. It just nonetheless comes down to the fact that it is a cultural indicator. And you'll also recall that other universities contacted by the Associated Press said that even though they don't have policies to protect students to allow them to take Samhain or another pagan holiday, they say they have, and I'm quoting here, catch-all policies that protect students of every religious faith. That's kind of the way it's going. On many university campuses, you just have a set number of excused absences, and you can use them however you wish without penalty. And that's what's really coming down here is the way that perhaps postmodern America is deciding to deal with much of this. It makes you wonder, given the agenda of secularism in this country, it makes you wonder how long it will be before Christmas is now an elective holiday. You can take it off and take off work without penalty or Easter or any other day. But it's not because the society recognizes that a majority of its own citizens are observing these holidays. But rather, in postmodern America, I don't think it'll be long. Until you just have a number of holidays, you sort them out as you wish on your own calendar. And I think we're seeing that agenda coming to pass, whether it's acknowledged or not. An even more troubling report is coming out of CNN. and it's located in Tampa, Florida. I'm going to read you the lead from this article from CNN. It says some cable congregations, some Christian congregations, particularly in lower-income urban areas, are turning to an unlikely source for help, the Church of Scientology. Now, notice the second paragraph of the story. Scientologists do not worship God, much less Jesus Christ. The church has seen plenty of controversy, and critics consider it a cult. So why are observant Christians observing some of the teachings? Two pastors did speak to CNN, Charles Kennedy, the Glorious Church of God in Christ, a Pentecostal church in Tampa. The other, the Reverend James McLaughlin of the Wayman Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Houston, Texas. They say they're not scared off by Scientology and its reputation, its secularism, and the fact that it has nothing to do with Christianity. Instead, they see it as, quote, a tool to augment their faith. Now, let me just suggest to you that syncretism, that's what this word is, syncretism, the right word, it means pulling together different beliefs, different doctrines, different tenets, different rituals, different practices from religions and putting together in something new. This has been something that the Christian faith has recognized from the beginning as a grave and deadly seduction. What you do is transform Christianity into something other than Christianity. Let's be really clear here. They can bring no mixing of Christianity and Scientology. It's impossible. They are opposites. They are not compatible. They are in no way congruent. They cannot be mixed. And so what you look at with this kind of story from CNN is just further evidence of the doctrinal abdication, indeed the doctrinal vacuity of so much of what calls itself Christianity. If Christian pastors can say that Scientology offers a way to augment their faith, I can only say they can't understand the faith. Because Scientology is its repudiation, not its augmentation. On this program, we spent an entire hour talking about the Daring Book for Boys and what it means. Now, HarperCollins is out with the Daring Book for Girls. The Dangerous Book for Boys hit the bestseller list, and so far as I know, is still selling thousands and thousands of copies. But after the Dangerous Book for Boys comes the Daring Book for Girls. I looked at it in the bookstore. It's much the same in terms of the way it's put together. The Dangerous Book for Boys is bright red. In a similar Victorian package, you have the Daring Book for Girls. There is a major advertisement in the New York Times today. It says this is perfect for every girl with an independent spirit and a nose for trouble. Pick up the ultimate No Boys Allowed guide to adventure. Now, I think there are several things that are interesting here. Number one, there is the belief that because there was the Dangerous Book for Boys, there must be some kind of an analogous companion book for girls. And you know that if any major publisher is publishing a companion book for girls after the Dangerous Book for Boys, it's going to have to come out and say, girls can do anything boys can do. Girls can be just as dangerous as boys. And they choose the word daring for the title of this book. And I looked at the book. I didn't see anything immediately offensive in it. But it's just a reminder that that certainly there is a resistance in this culture still to the idea that there's any difference. And I guess we should at least appreciate the fact that in publishing the Daring Book for Girls and having different interests in it, including gymnastics and other things like that, there's at least some recognition of difference. But in this society, if you acknowledge difference between boys and girls, men and women in any way, you're immediately on the defensive. Let's look for the response to this book and see what it looks like. It'll be fascinating. It'll tell us a great deal of where we are in this culture. The Wall Street Journal is out with a story today suggesting that homecoming is losing out in the lives of young people. And it is located, this story in particular, through one of the persons involved with the Wall Street Journal writing of his own teenage daughter. This is the way he begins the story. This is by Jeffrey Zaslow of the Wall Street Journal. He says, last month, a boy asked my 16-year-old daughter to his school's homecoming dance. She agreed to go, bought a new dress, and made a hairdresser appointment. The boy never bought tickets to the dance, neither did his friends. They decided that attending homecoming wouldn't be cool and instead planned to just dress up for that night, go out for dinner, and then hang out with their dates at someone's house. He says, my daughter was disappointed, as was her girlfriends. Now, this phenomenon that Mr. Zaslow explains here in details is about hooking up, now winning over homecoming. Now, I don't know Mr. Zaslow. I can simply tell you that I wouldn't let my daughter, nor for that matter my son, get involved in this in the first place. This hooking up culture, so well described by novelist Thomas Wolfe, is a lifestyle in which you have people who are hooking up basically for sex. What you have here is the rejection of an institution even such as the homecoming dance, whatever you think of that, in favor of just hanging out with friends at someone's house. This is another way of avoiding institutional settings where young people mix together with both genders. It's a way of avoiding adult supervision. It's a way of avoiding the male avoiding the responsibility of what even anthropologists and sociologists call courtship rituals. It's simply hanging out. Mr. Zaslow is right about this. Girls are the losers because boys here are aggressive and they're looking for something other than the formality of a homecoming event. And I think we know what they're looking for. And so does Mr. Zaslow. We'll be back to talk with Dinesh D'Souza about what's great about Christianity and offer some advice about how to answer the militant atheist getting so much attention in the public square. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the Albert Mueller Program. These are interesting days. The public airwaves and so much of the media context is now taken up with a discussion that has featured a great deal of what can just be described as militant atheism. And whether it's Christopher Hitchens or Daniel Dennett or Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or others, there is a new sense that a militant atheism is projecting itself into the public square. Dinesh D'Souza is a best-selling author. Many of you know him as a former domestic policy analyst in the White House. He has written a new book that is entitled, What's So Great About Christianity? And as he begins the book, he says this, today's Christians know that they do not, as their ancestors did, live in a society where God's presence was unavoidable. No longer does Christianity form the moral basis of society. Many of us now reside in secular communities where arguments drawn from the Bible or Christian revelation carry no weight, and where we hear a different language from that spoken in church. Dinesh, why did you write the book, What's So Great About Christianity?
Well, I've been for 15 years a secular writer. I've written 7 books. But I felt that something new is happening today, and that is we're seeing for the first time atheism become a serious option for people, and particularly for young people. A generation ago, the poster child of atheism was someone like Madeleine Murray O'Hare or some rumpled ACLU lawyer, not a very attractive image for atheism worldwide. But now the atheists come out of the universities, they have scientific credentials, or like Christopher Hitchens, they're stylish, they're witty, and many young people are attracted to this kind of thing. So I felt it's important to have, if you will, a 21st century apologetic that took the atheist argument seriously, met it on its own ground of reason and science and evidence. And so that's the goal of What's So Great About Christianity, to challenge atheism on its own terms and defeat it.
Well, I found the book very interesting, and I appreciate the fact that you wrote it. You know, this whole idea of a militant atheism being something new is, I think, a slightly historically misleading. And when you look back in the 19th century, someone like Robert Ingersoll, and then you look in the 20th century, someone like Bertrand Russell, as well as Madeleine Murray O'Hare, whom you mentioned. But there has always been the sense that atheism was something of a fringe in Western civilization, and that the fundaments, the foundations of the civilization were pervasively Christian, and that was a good thing. I think one of the things you acknowledge in your book is that this new breed of militant atheists really looks at what they acknowledge to be the Christian foundations of civilization and says that they are negative, evil, oppressive, intolerant, and something we should simply repudiate and grow beyond.
Yeah, years ago, Bertrand Russell, after he wrote his book about Why I Am Not a Christian, somebody asked him, if you die and you find yourself before God, what would you say? And Russell very pompously said, I would say, sir, you did not give me enough evidence. So this was the old banner of atheism. It claimed intellectual superiority, the sort of search for evidence. The new atheism, however, strangely also clothes itself in the garb of morality. It accuses religion, and specifically Christianity, of being behind most of the violence and evil and wars and suffering and even terrorism in the world. So this is, an atheism that is flying on the wings of 9/11. It demands a new kind of an answer.
One of the things you cover in your book is something we talk about regularly on this program, and that is that social location really does impact the way you look at things. And you mentioned living in California, and you make the very keen observation that if you live in New York or California, you can believe that America is growing to be an increasingly secular place. But if you live elsewhere in the country, much less elsewhere in the world, you see a very different pattern. You talk about the global triumph of Christianity in the twilight of atheism. Dinesh, let me ask you a question. If atheism represents so few worldwide, why does it get so much attention?
It gets so much attention because it occupies very influential sectors of American and Western life. Atheism is strong in the universities. It's strong in the media. It's perhaps not as strong in politics, but because we have this notion of separation of church and government, the political square is dominated, if you will, by secularists. They've figured out a very clever con in which the religious people are driven out of the public square, and the atheist idea of fairness is to have a monopoly of public space. So for all these reasons, we live in a culture that is publicly secular. If someone were to come from Mars and visit America and walk around our public buildings, watch television, turn on the music, read books, you would have no idea that the majority of Americans are Christian. You would have no idea that you are in a society that is a Christian society.
So when you look at that picture, what would you suggest that Christians should do? Simply sit back and make observations about the growing secularism of the elites, or engage the issues? What do you suggest?
I think we have a clear biblical mandate to be not of the world, but in it. We're all told to love God not just with our hearts, but with our minds. And we're told to give a reason for the hope that is within us. So I think as Christians, we should be in the culture, fully engaged, not, if you will, conceding all this territory to the atheists. Because let's remember, this is not just a debate about putting up a monument in a public building. The atheists have very clearly said that their goal is to go after our children. In other words, they know that they haven't won the battle for the current generation. But they're hoping that through the schools and through the universities, as young Christians come into school, come into college, and remember, as in my case, when I went to college, I was a Christian, but the Christianity I learned was a very juvenile, you can call it crayon Christianity, and so it was very vulnerable to skeptical assault. So as Christians, we're sending our children off. They're going to get a withering attack on their faith. We've got to prepare ourselves. Even more important, we've got to prepare them. And we can't just prepare them ultimately with scriptural truth. We also have to prepare them with intellectual and moral defenses so that they can fend off the attacks that will surely come.
Now, one of the most interesting lines in your book is something that's been argued in different words by different people. Your chapter in which you deal with why unbelief is so appealing, you mention that the current rebellion of these atheists is rather limited. In other words, they're not trying to get rid of the Christian ideal of charity, much like Nietzsche did. They're not suggesting that that's a form of weakness. They're not arguing against humanitarianism, as Nietzsche and other atheist philosophers did. You say this. You say that their rebellion is more confined. It is, one may say, a pelvic revolt against God. I know what you mean there. Tell our audience what you mean.
Well, very often when you talk to the atheist, you get the idea that simply because of evolution and Darwin and so on, the guy is encountering great intellectual difficulties. But you only have to probe the atheist a little more to realize there's a lot more to it than that. For example, Christopher Hitchens, in the debate I had with him in New York City recently, he said, "I'm not an atheist, I'm an anti-theist," meaning I don't just not believe, I don't like God. I hate the Christian God, and in particular what these guys hate is Christian morality. Morality, after all, introduces accountability. It suggests that there is a last judgment in which we are ultimately going to have to answer for what we have done. It also suggests that the things that we do in this world, even the things we do in private, even the things we do in the dark, are in some ways under observation, under supervision, maybe even being recorded. This to the atheist is a total nightmare. And so in a sense, the atheist has devised a very cunning solution. There's an easy way to get rid of moral accountability. There's an easy way to escape out from under the shadow of moral judgment. Just abolish the judge. And you can imagine young people coming to college and so on, buckling under the idea, I've got the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that. And the atheist whispers in his ear, oh, listen, none of this is really binding. You don't have to accept this notion of an old man with a long beard handing all this out. Morality is stuff we make up as we go along. What a tempting, what an attractive idea to whisper in the minds of young people who are chafing under morality anyway.
Yeah, no doubt. One observer that I remember some time back referred to modernity itself, the Enlightenment, its aftermath, as a form of rationalized sexual misbehavior. And so often that's what it comes down to, and that's why, as Mr. D'Souza argues, it is particularly attractive to the young who are seeking to overthrow any kind of moral restraint. Back with author Dinesh D'Souza in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Our guest today is best-selling author Dinesh D'Souza. His new book, What's So Great About Christianity, is now available in your local bookstore. And just a few weeks ago, he debated one of the most well-known of these militant atheists at King's College in Manhattan. He debated Christopher Hitchens. Listen to this statement made by Christopher Hitchens.
A virgin can conceive. A dead body can walk again. Your leprosy can be cured. The blind can see. Nonsense. It's not moral to lie to children. It's not moral to lie to ignorant, uneducated people and to tell them that if they will only believe nonsense, they can be saved. It's immoral.
Dinesh D'Souza, Mr. Hitchens suggests that these claims central to Christianity are immoral. What was your response?
Well, I think as the debate went on, it became very clear that he was the one who was ignorant, and ignorant of science itself, because remember that science is based on general propositions, but of no scientific principle can it be said that there are no exceptions to it. To take a simple example, even if you were to look, for example, at the speed of light, the speed of light is widely known to be 186,000 miles per second if light is traveling in a vacuum. Now, how do we know that? Because the scientists have measured it. But if you measure it one time, or five times, or 10 times, or even 1,000,000 times, you don't know that light travels at that speed everywhere. For example, there might be a star 1,000,000 light years away. We don't know if light travels at that speed over there. And this is true of all scientific laws. They are generalizations drawn from experience, but they are not logically, they are not logical necessities. So I asked Christopher Hitchens very straightforwardly, name for me one scientific law that you know in an unrestricted sense is true. And he said, I can't name a single one. So I said, thank you very much, because after all, if we don't know that these laws are true in the sense of logical necessity, then miracles are possible.
You know, Dinesh, it seems to me the most interesting and haunting part of that statement from Christopher Hitchens has to do with his reference to children. He says it's not moral to lie to children, suggesting that any claim of theism or belief in God, any doctrinal teaching associated with Christianity is inherently a lie. You have similar lines of argument coming from Richard Dawkins, who suggests that it should be considered immoral for parents to impress their beliefs upon their children. Even Daniel Dennett is suggesting that children are helpless and thus should be seen as often victimized by the faith of their parents. You know, do you not see that one of the great dangers out there is that there's a cultural movement towards suggesting that children have a right not to be trained in the faith by their parents?
I think what's going on here, and this is, by the way, why Christian apologetics is indispensable for Christian families. At one time, people could have said, listen, I'll just go by faith. I won't worry about all this. But what we're seeing here is an atheist campaign to say parents have no right to teach their children. And if they do, if they are programming blind faith into their children, it's the job of the schools and the universities to deprogram it, to take it out. So for these reasons, I think our sons and daughters are being sent out into the world, and the brightest of them are bound to feel the force of this kind of atheist attack. We've got to prepare them for it.
Dinesh, let me ask you to tell us basically how you came to become a Christian. How did this happen in your life?
In my case, I was born in Bombay, India. My family was Christian, converted by Portuguese missionaries going back some centuries. But the Christianity I learned was ultimately just a Christianity of habit. It was not a thoughtful Christianity. When I went to Dartmouth as an undergraduate, I found people saying things to me like, the universe operates according to fixed laws. How can you say that someone was born of a virgin or walked on the ocean or changed water into wine? And I really couldn't defend my faith, so I found myself drifting away. Not that I didn't want to believe, but my mind was becoming an obstacle. It's only in later years that I began to think harder about Christianity. I also obviously I married a young woman from Louisiana who's an evangelical Christian. We go to a Calvary Chapel church in California. So through my wife and through a pastor, I began to go back and look at the things I had learned as a child and realize that there is a mature, adult, intelligent Christianity that can withstand this skeptical assault. And so what I've done in recent years is move my own work, my own scholarship, and in this book, What's So Great About Christianity, I bring historical, philosophical, scientific arguments to bear in defending Christianity against its strongest critics.
It has been a privilege to have today Dinesh D'Souza, best-selling author, and to have him discuss his new book, What's So Great About Christianity. Dinesh, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
When we come back, we're going to talk about the arguments that he makes in this book, and we're going to talk about how we should respond to this new militant atheism in our midst. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Give us a call. How would you answer these same atheists? This is the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back. You know, thus far in America, we have something of a quartet of these militant atheists. Richard Dawkins, a professor at Oxford University. Christopher Hitchens, a literary figure and quite a savage wit. Samuel Harris, who's at Stanford University writing as a scientist. And Daniel Dennett at Tufts University, another scientist. If you were to cross the pond to Britain or to Europe, you would find a far larger constellation of more militant atheists. And when you get to France in particular, you find a breed of extremely virulent atheism where they are willing to take the argument a bit further, even, and this might be hard for some people to imagine, even further than the Hitchens and the Dawkins and all the rest. I think one of the most interesting things to observe out of all of this is that so many of these authors really direct their attention to children. And the suggestion is that children ought to be allowed to be raised in something like a religion-free zone, in which parents would not seek to impress their beliefs upon children. I just want to tell you that that's not a new idea either. As a matter of fact, that was central to one of the leading theorists of the public school movement, what was known as the common school movement in America in the 20th century. You have John Dewey in particular, who argued that children needed to be taken into the schools, the public schools, in order to remove them from the religious prejudices of their parents. And so this is not a new argument, but the reality is that it's newly invigorated, and it certainly is newly popularized in the public square. My prediction is this. As we move forward in years ahead, number one, you can count on publishers jumping on a winning bandwagon. And when there's one book that works, publishers line up to publish similar works. We kind of talked about that at the top. If you have the dangerous book for boys that knocks out the bestseller lists, you know, it's not long until you end up with the daring book for girls. If one atheist hits the New York Times bestseller list by denying God, someone's going to come along with an even more atrocious and more dead-on rejectionist argument, and they're likely to reach the New York Times bestseller list, too. A lot of this is marketing. Some of it is intellectual context. But I think one of the things you're going to see is that the proposals are going to become more concrete. This is exactly the way it took place in Europe, and I think we should expect that similar things will happen here. When the proposals become more concrete, you have the proposals that we need to separate American public life from any Christian influence in the name of pluralism, in the name of tolerance, in the name of the separation of church and state. And the challenge is going to be this. Will the American people be sophisticated enough, historically aware enough, and clear-headed enough to understand that this ultimately leads to a fully secular state and a fully secular culture with a fully secularized morality? Now, one of the best aspects of Dinesh D'Souza's book, What's So Great About Christianity, is that he really looks at what a secular morality might look like and what it might touch. And the reality is that a secular morality just can't get you very far. This isn't to say that secularists can't be moral people in the sense of living upright lives. It is to say that if you do follow a particular, clear, and straightforward, intellectually honest secularism, then large parts of morality that are a part of Christian morality, what some would prefer to call Judeo-Christian morality, are simply taken off the table. And in particular, sexual morality is the first to go. And tell me if that's not where we are. That's what we're looking at right now. We're looking at proposals that sexual morality be severed from public life. We talked about that just a few days ago with relation to the question of public office and marriage. And the suggestion is being made, we need to clearly separate, clearly and cleanly divide issues of private sexual behavior, marital behavior, marital fidelity from public life, from public leadership. There is also the suggestion that we simply need to allow a sexual morality to be reduced to nothing more than consent. So I want you to follow with me where this leads. If you do hold to a fully secular morality, just about the only moral principle you can come up with sex is consent. And as a matter of fact, I would dare you to come up with anything other than that. Because if two people, or why limit it to two? If any number of people consent to a sexual behavior, then who's to say they're wrong? If you overthrow all Judeo-Christian biblical sexual morality, if you overthrow the inherited moral wisdom based upon Christian foundations, then how can you say that anything that is consensual could be wrong? You know, you then have to footnote what it means to give consent. And so you end up with things such as the sex codes found in modern American corporations, in professional practice, and on university campuses. You find things such as the fact that an employer cannot rightly expect consent from an employee. So you have at many colleges, for instance, and in many companies, a sanction against someone who is in an adulterous or a non-marital relationship if there is an employee-employer relationship. So that's the only morality. It's kind of a bureaucratic sexual morality. And then they'll come along and footnote consent by saying, well, if you have children can't give consent. And then you have to answer the very interesting question that right now is being debated in England and in Europe, and that is the age of sexual consent. And there have been proposals in the American media, even in recent days, to lower the age of consent for minors, children, young people in America today. And this is inevitable. If we buy into this worldview of autonomous secular individualism, then eventually children at younger and younger ages are presumed to be moral actors on their own behalf, in their own autonomous selves. And so this is the amazing thing to see. And so when you look at the attacks from Dawkins and Dennett and Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris, and you say, you know, I don't see America buying into that argument. My response is this. You don't see many Americans buying it bold face, cover to cover, in whole. You see America adopting it piece by piece, often without any awareness of what is happening. And you have a secular morality and a secular logic replacing the Judeo-Christian logic that has undergirded Western civilization. There are many historians that will tell you that an honest review of the last centuries will underline that no Christianity means no Europe. No Christianity means no clear understanding of the meaning of a Christian, of a human person and human dignity, no ordered liberty, no understanding of freedom. Just find where in the world these things emerged without a Christian, without a biblical foundation. Go somewhere in the world and find out where ordered liberty, individual freedom, the dignity of every single human life is understood in the way that Western nations and Western civilization have embraced them. And find where that has taken place without Christianity, without the Bible, without Christian teaching and Christian tradition, and without the clear understanding that every single individual is indeed made in the image of God. I challenge you, just go find it. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Dinesh D'Souza's book, What's So Great About Christianity, is available in your local bookstore, and I would commend that you read it. It is a good compendium of arguments. Now, the interesting thing is that this raises the question, how do Christians read books? First of all, let's just hope that Christians do read books. That would be a very positive aspect of intellectual discipleship. But how should we read a book? Even when you look at a book by someone like Dinesh D'Souza, you know, who is himself a Christian, very boldly identifying himself as a Christian, he makes brilliant arguments and very keen observations in this book. You also need to read it saying, you know, how do we take every paragraph, how do we take every chapter, every argument and measure it over against Scripture? In this book, he makes some proposals about evolution. He suggests that Christians should embrace evolutionary theory and deny the materialist worldview of Darwinism. Now, for instance, when I read that, I say that would be a neat trick, only if possible. I don't think it is possible. I don't think that is the best way to respond to evolution. But nonetheless, I found myself having to think through the issues all over again and thinking about my position on these issues, reading Dinesh D'Souza's book. So even when we talk about a book and we recommend a book and say you ought to buy a book, this doesn't mean that on every page there's nothing with which you might have to take a second thought. The point is, and this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, Christians need to read intelligently. And this is a very fine book written by a very intelligent Christian. Again, the title is What's So Great About Christianity? I would suggest that it would be very helpful to many young people, especially on university and college campuses. And if you find yourself wondering, what kind of book can I put in the hands of someone who's reading Daniel Dennett or Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or Christopher Hitchens, this is one of those books. And it's one of those books that really does get to the basic issues. It is intellectually credible. He dignifies the question. He talks about the issues in a way that is not only as credible as those he's seeking to answer, but I would argue even more credible. But that's also bringing to light the reason why I ask him the question of his story. I mean, in reality, not only do we as Christians talk about the truths of the Christian faith, not only do we defend these truths and our right to articulate these truths and to share the faith and to teach and preach the faith, to live out the Christian faith, but we also need to tell people the story. And I, for one, was very touched by Mr. D'Souza speaking of how he became a Christian. I mean, after all, we are not merely hoping that people will be unconvinced of atheism. We're not even merely hoping that they will be convinced of Christianity. We're hoping that they'll come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. That means that apologetics is necessary, but in the end, it's never the end of the story. It's necessary, but not sufficient. Evangelism has to follow apologetics, and the true apologetic motivation is always, rightly, evangelism. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.